The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Robot Apocalypse edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the century. Mm-hmm. We are zooming out this week, and well, let me just tell you, this is going to be a good one, because not only do we have Cathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Mass Destruction, the greatest book ever written.
Hello, everyone.
But we also, standing in for the randomly flaky Jordan Weissman,
That's not fair.
We have a much better finance blogger. So true fact, I opened up a job for Ryan Avent once.
Kind of.
I moved from portfolio.com to Reuters.com, and in doing so, opened up a finance blogger position at portfolio.com, which was filled by Mr. Ryan Avent for how long?
2 weeks. All of 2 weeks.
It was not the most awesome of bequests.
It was a good experience. It was a learning experience.
Basically,
very short-lived.
Basically, 2 weeks after I left, they took a look around, realized that without me there was no future, and shut the entire thing down.
Absolutely. That's one story, yeah.
But Ryan amazingly managed to recover from this blow. And what are you up to now?
I am the Economist, where I had been blogging before, welcomed me back with open arms, and I've never
there wasn't one of those Bloomberg again. Rules at the Economist saying that once you leave, like even if it's only for 2 weeks,
you have to serve time in the wilderness.
Yeah. Is that a rule of Bloomberg?
That's a rule of Bloomberg. No re-entry at Bloomberg,
including Michael Bloomberg. I guess not.
So you're back at the Economist. You've been back there ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And you somehow, in between writing learned treatises within its august pages, have managed to publish a book.
I have indeed.
Which is called?
It is called The Wealth of Humans, Work, Power, and Status in the 21st Century.
And it's an excellent book. So
All good books have to have subtitles nowadays, by the way.
Yeah, what's up with subtitles?
I think it's because, you know, they really want a catchy title. But a really, really catchy title usually doesn't have that much information about what's in the book.
Yeah. Especially there was the kind of wave of one word titles.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Blink. And
yeah, but it's like how much information does that give you?
Salt kind of does what it says on the tin, right? It's a book about salt. You don't really need a subtitle.
Okay, all right. Sometimes you don't need a subtitle.
Anyway, this is a very clever title, The Wealth of Humans. And I would guess that some subset of our listeners will be able to understand what, like, the three different meanings thereof.
There are a few different meanings. It's I'm sort of saying that I'm the next Adam Smith, which I guess is a bit, you know, bold of me.
Because Adam Smith famously wrote
The Wealth of Nations.
You see, it rhymes.
Yes. But then it's also referring both to kind of the common wealth that we generate as a society, the wealth of humans, and then also the fact that what seems to be going wrong with the economy right now is that we are faced with a wealth of humans, a glut of labor.
We have billions of the things all over the world. Mm-hmm. We're having to try and work out what on earth we're going to do with them all.
That's right.
So that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the book. We are going to talk a little bit. And of course, like, the reason why we're calling this the Robot Apocalypse Edition is because, like, in the face of these billions of humans, all of whom want work, we also have the robots who are stealing their jobs. So we're going to talk a little bit about what happens to humans when the robots steal their jobs, and specifically about what happens to bank tellers when ATMs come along.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the one thing we haven't talked about in the past couple of weeks in great depth is this whole Wells Fargo fiasco. So we knew we weren't talking about it. We were just waiting for Ryan to come on because Ryan is awesome.
Well, we did. I had it in the numbers round.
We did have it in the numbers round. And then we are also going to talk about the robots just completely taking over in the form of the Amazon algorithm and what that means for people shopping on the internet. But yes, Ryan, let's start with the book. Let's start with this whole question of the billions and billions of people who mm-hmm. need work. Like, historically, how have people got work, and how is that changing?
Well, so historically, when we think about what technology has done, we say, it destroys jobs, but it also creates a lot of new jobs at the same time. So you get rid of kind of the people who are manning, certain kinds of loom, but then you create others in related jobs and people to kind of balance the books and all sorts of other things. And so we end up with more jobs overall, and everyone's kind of happy. But in practice, this process is never super neat. It's always kind of messy. And so even back in the 19th century, we had to do things like move people around, move them to new cities. We had to get them educated and do all these things to help them adjust. And the kind of the rub this time around is that we have this digital revolution that is kind of replacing people at a really fast pace. And we are having a much more difficult time helping workers adjust because the cities where a lot of the jobs are being created are super expensive, like San Francisco and New York, because we've already given the kind of the basic education. We've already made that kind of a mandatory thing that everyone does, goes through secondary school and then goes on, in a lot of cases, to university. And it's not easy then to take people and say, well, now you have to go get a PhD in, computer engineering or whatever. So these levers that were always there before to help us adjust aren't anymore. And so this glut of labor, these billions of people looking for jobs, the way that they end up finding work is by accepting low pay.
So one thing that I found interesting is, and, very useful for someone like myself who almost always thinks about the United States, like when I think about economics, is your international perspective. And you talk about sort of the normal evolution of economies going through industrialization and such and such. But you make the point that nowadays, when you're a country going through industrialization, it happens at a much faster clip, and there's problems with that. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So one of the things contributing to this abundance of humans, this wealth of humans competing for work, is this hyper-globalization, as it's been called, that took place over the last 20 years. And it used to be the case that if you wanted to grow rich, you had to kind of start your way at the very bottom and build your industrial base from kind of making plastics and toys and slowly work your way up to cars and then computers and things like that. Over the last 20 years, that totally changed. Companies like Apple could use information technology to monitor stuff that was going on half a world away. And so suddenly you had supply chains spreading out all over the world. And that kind of supercharged the pace of globalization because you didn't have to learn how to do everything from the ground up. You could just say, okay, well, we can have a factory here and assemble things, and everyone else will do kind of the hard bits. And one of the side effects of this was suddenly we had over a billion workers in China and India and other places competing with manufacturing workers in the rich world, which had a very kind of destabilizing effect on a lot of manufacturing industries and communities there. Of course, it's also meant great change in the places that we're doing this rapid catch up.
But the insight you have in this book, which I think is absolutely true, is that if you're an old-fashioned country growing up in terms of being able to make everything yourself, what you wind up doing is building a bunch of institutions, you call them social capital, which lay the groundwork for prosperity, basically. And if you are, by contrast, somewhere like China, where you are building widget factories, which are extremely good at making widgets, that doesn't build those institutions in the same way. And a global economy dominated by supply chains in this sense makes it actually really hard for countries like China and India to build those solid institutions which will help them have prosperity over the long term.
Yeah, so it turns out that if you take advantage of this really rapid development, it ends up being really shallow, and that you don't build, as you say, the institutions, the financial networks, the kind of managerial capabilities, the systems to train people and allow them to kind of manage all the complexity of the global economy. And so when the kind of, the end of the road comes and you've kind of maxed out what you can do on global value change, you kind of don't have anywhere else to go. You don't have the capacity to be super innovative necessarily. If for whatever reason, high labor costs or other things, the factories go away, you're kind of stuck in that you don't have another, the next rung on the ladder isn't there.
I want to delve right into that idea that you have about social capital, because I honestly am unsatisfied with it as a well-defined concept. But I do think it makes a lot of sense in the following example, which you give in the book. So you talked about widget factories, and the idea with widget factories and in the context of capitalism is if, you're paying too much for widgets, another group of people would be like, hey, we'll make widgets for you, right? But with social capital, which is this new kind of amorphous, squishy thing, but it's valuable.
It accounts for 80% of the capitalization of the stock market.
Right. It kind of makes that scenario much harder to understand. So the example you had was like car companies. So we know that car companies are like deciding which state to settle in, and all the states are vying for their attention and saying, we'll give you tax credits and all this stuff. And the question is, like, in a free market economy, why don't people just say, hey, well, you know, screw that, we'll just start our own car company? And the answer is that actually it's the culture and the sort of institutional knowledge of the car company that makes it doable. People can't just up and make a car company.
Right.
And one of the things which was going through my head when I read that was that there is one very famous new car company. It's called Tesla. And Tesla, fascinatingly, has basically rejected the supply chain model. And instead, it's building this gigafactory, which is going to do everything in one place. And one of the fascinating things about Tesla is that while all other car companies can produce a car every like 15 seconds or something, the one thing which Tesla's been really, really, really bad at from day one and has always undershot its expectations by massive amounts is sheer volume of production. It has the most high-tech factory in the world, but it doesn't have, it just, that one factory, if you try and do everything in one place like Tesla does, it turns out that getting the throughput that is perfectly normal for every other car company in the world is unbelievably difficult. And that could actually be Tesla's big Achilles heel, that it just doesn't have the ability to produce cars fast enough.
Well, I think you can bring that back to the idea of social capital a bit, in the sense that other car companies have been in existence, and the ones that have survived in a highly competitive market have done so because they kind of learn as institutions. They're like organisms, and they kind of figure out how to evolve in a way that they can identify problems and fix them. And so, you know, famously, Toyota developed this new kind of culture where they were able to very quickly identify problems on the line and fix them. And subsequently, all the other car companies kind of learned to do this. I think that's the kind of thing that you can't just, you know, no matter how, even if you've got a genius like Elon Musk kind of running the show, he can't know every single aspect of in the production process like the back of his hand.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of the details of what goes on inside Foxconn that Apple is basically unaware of. And that's kind of the genius of the market, is that you throw a bunch of money at something, and then if it doesn't work, then the money flows somewhere else. And so there's competition for the way to do things most effectively, which you don't have inside a gigafactory. You don't have that kind of market-based competition which makes things more and more effective over time.
So, I mean, I like the idea of social capital in this example of car manufacturing, but I feel like because it's hard to define and hard to measure in other places, it becomes kind of a circular argument. Like, we talk about social capital is what makes America so rich, but then on the other hand, you know, you also say that most countries lack social capital, which is why they're not rich. So it almost seems like a circular definition.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I'll be the first to admit that it's a really woolly concept. It's really hard to define and basically impossible to measure except as kind of a residual, like whatever's left over. I try in the book to give a pretty clear definition of what I mean by social capital, and that is patterns of behavior that people adopt in particular contexts. So, you know, if you take someone who is a merchant in sub-Saharan Africa, they have a way of doing business there. If you then allow them to immigrate to the United States, they're capable of learning what the different norms are here and functioning in a different way. And as it turns out, those different norms allow that merchant to be much more productive and profitable. And I think it's even the kind of way this works is even more clear-cut within firms. Firms often have very weird, very well-defined cultures. And those cultures are there basically to help the company figure out what matters and make decisions based on that information. And it boils down to small things like, you know, does your boss like it when you come in, you know, unprompted and say, you know, this looks dumb, this thing that we're doing here, we should fix it. Or is there something more formal about the way things operate? Those little things all add up into patterns of behavior that everyone kind of understands, not written down anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's like the code that makes makes a piece of software run.
And it's true. And I really do appreciate the fact that you mentioned Bill Gates as an example of someone who, like, yes, he's a genius, but if he had been born in a different place in a different time, he would not have succeeded the way he has. You do spend quite a bit of time, just like you just referenced, talking about, you know, if we wanted to help humans, then we would allow much, much more immigration. Could you talk a little bit about why that's true and why it's not happening?
Well, I think one of the implications of the view, which I have in the book, that social capital matters, is that one of the best ways to make people rich is by moving them into communities in which the social capital seems to be pretty effective at generating wealth. And so that could be a big company like Apple. It could be a place like Silicon Valley, or it could be a country like the United States, where the institutions are, you know, able to allow people like Bill Gates to get rich. There's been a lot of effort within economics and social science generally to figure out, you know, how can we go to a place like Rwanda and improve the institutions there, right? So that they can be as rich as everyone else. I mean, it's not like there's any miracle to the technology or the knowledge. It's all, more or less public. They just need to be able to take advantage of it. But it turns out that's just really, really difficult to do.
Well, every time you bring that up in the book, it just kind of riles me up because it's kind of – I feel like it's overly decontextualized from the actual history that, like, basically Europeans have had with Africans. You know, it's like, oh, we try so hard to help them. You know, and it's like, could we add a little more historical context to that?
So there have been lots of times in which we've been less than helpful in our efforts to kind of
– And that's not irrelevant to the idea of us trying to help them now. It's not like theoretically impossible.
It's not even a question of whether we're trying to help or not. The fact is that although there have been, I think, three small middle-income countries which have managed to transition successfully into high-income countries.
Like Singapore.
Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan, basically. No one outside, like, small Asian countries has ever been able to do that. This is a really, really hard thing. And it's not a function of whether or not, you know, quote-unquote, we in the West are being helpful or unhelpful. I mean, probably at the margin we're unhelpful.
Right.
But still, there's a bunch of Western countries which did manage to do it, and it does seem to be incredibly difficult going forwards. And there might be a legacy of imperialism and colonialism which makes it even harder to do that, but that's like a given. That's a sunk cost now. And the question is, how do you try and overcome it?
Right.
Well, one of the things that I think you do to try to overcome that is to redefine who we are, right? You know, so often the conversations, especially around elections, are, you know, about us. Like, how do we bring jobs back onshore and stuff? And
it's
this is decidedly an international scope. We're talking about international immigration. Like, how do we help the most people, even if it's not particularly politically viable?
That there's, like, I mean, and this is one of the themes in the book, that, you know, there's a few relatively simple but politically basically impossible things which would make the world a lot better off. Number one, free up a bunch of the zoning restrictions in places like Silicon Valley and New York City and London. Number two, massively increase the amount of international migration and, you know, possibly do something like an international humanitarian passport for refugees. You know, that would just it doesn't cost much to do those kind of things, and it creates a huge amount of wealth.
And but he also talks about basic income guarantee, by the way.
I don't know if we have time to talk about basic income, but I do want to talk about the real question which you raise at the beginning of the book, and you don't particularly answer, maybe because it's not entirely answerable, which is, we have this connection in our mind between work and value. Work is how we get the money to buy things. Work is how we define our own value. When you become unemployed for any length of time, that's like medically disastrous for people, because the whole way we define ourselves is in terms of what our jobs are, how valuable our work is. As more and more jobs get taken by robots, and assuming that the world continues to become wealthier and we manage to come up with some kind of redistribution mechanism, to what degree is that going to go away, or will it, or is this linkage between work and self-worth just sort of hardwired into humanity?
Or do we just need to redefine what work is?
I think there will be some sort of social redefinition of not just what work is, but what it means to contribute to society. But yeah, I mean, work is one of the fundamental institutions in society, and it's an incredibly convenient one because it's a way both to kind of encourage people to do things and give them the purchasing power they need, while also kind of, you know, structuring their day. And I don't think we're going to find a single thing that solves all those problems in the future. But, you know, I think whatever we come up with, we'll need to do a few things. It will need to redistribute wealth in some way so that people can buy food and put a roof over their heads. It will need to provide some sort of structure to people's lives because they seek that. And not just structure, but a sense of agency, a sense that people are doing something that's meaningful. And then it will also have to have some sort of social currency attached to it, and that, you know, the people involved in whatever this is, be it volunteerism or, you know, community service of some sort, are contributing in a way that then entitles them to be a part of the community and receive the redistribution back. It's that kind of bargain that society strikes that is so nice about work, and that we're really going to miss when we lose that.
And the universal basic income basically does one of those three.
Right, exactly. Right.
Okay, so let's...
The last thing I want to say about the book is that there are references to Star Trek, which is good. It's always good.
And our good friend Manu Sardia is actually cited in the book, which he's very excited about, I can tell you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So let's get specific. Let's move from generalities to specifics. And let's talk about the ATM, which is one of the most efficient and well-designed robots that, you know, has come along in the past few decades. And it transformed the world of retail banking. It used to be that when you needed to get money, you had have to go to a bank teller, and then the bank teller would count out your money and, you know, write down on a piece of paper how much money was left in your bank account. And there was this whole thing which Americans still like to think is an important thing called balancing your checkbook.
I do that.
You do that?
Really?
Oh, my God.
Wow. I still write checks. I prefer them over PayPal. Like, just
wow.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that whole thing, I mean, Kathy, you know, notwithstanding, has gone the way of the dinosaurs. And there's this much more convenient thing called the ATM, which just does all of that for you. And the obvious consequence of the rise of the ATM was that all of the bank tellers would lose their job because their job was replaced by a robot. That didn't happen, did it,
Kathy? What happened? I mean, I keep on wondering to the extent to which it didn't happen. I mean, obviously there's more ATMs than there used to be banks, but most of those ATMs are just standalone ATMs.
There are more banks than there used to be banks.
That's true, too.
This is what...
There's just way too many banks.
I will tell you what happened because, yeah, this is what the economists like to call a stylized fact. There are like slightly... you can quibble with the details, but broadly speaking, what happened is that the rise of the ATM meant that you needed fewer workers per branch. You didn't need as many tellers to be counting out money and to be taking the money in and sending it out and that kind of stuff. With fewer workers per branch, the cost of running a branch came down substantially. So you could open up more branches. And so that's the first thing that happened, is that more branches opened up because that's how you get customers, is by being convenient. People weirdly but overwhelmingly tend to open bank accounts just at like whichever bank is on the corner of wherever they live or where they work.
That explains my neighborhood, because there's like every single conceivable bank in my neighborhood.
But then the second thing that happened is that the job of the teller was transformed. It stopped being a question of writing numbers down on a ledger and adding up, you know, and giving out cash. And it became basically a sales job. And this is what happened at the most successful retail bank in the United States, possibly of all time, in any country ever. This bank called Wells Fargo, which Warren Buffett is a massive fan of and has made lots of money on. What Wells Fargo did more successfully than any other bank was it said, okay, tellers, you're not tellers anymore. You're the frontline sales staff. And your job is to sell financial products. And we are an institution which sells a whole bunch of financial products. We sell credit cards. We sell loans. We sell lines of credit. We sell mortgages. And when people come in, for whatever reason, and there's always some reason that someone goes into a bank, that's our most exciting opportunity to sell them new products. So just go out, sell.
Now, when's the last time you went to a bank to talk to a teller? I'm just curious.
The last time I did it was, I think, in June.
I did it this morning.
Did you do it this morning? Okay. Did they try to sell you on something?
They did try to sell me when I went in June.
Okay. Because my experience is that I don't think I've ever been – I won't tell you who I bank with, but I I don't think anyone has ever tried to sell me something
in
the bank.
It's been happened to me.
Anytime I call them, I'm asked multiple times whether I'd like X, Y, or Z financial product.
But. Well, I can tell you, Ryan, that number one, you've been in England too long. but number two, you don't bank with Wells Fargo. Because if you had banked with Wells Fargo, you would have experienced
I would now have 8 accounts, whether or not I need
them. Because it rhymes with great.
Wow.
This is, as the listener, I'm not making this up. As I'm sure most of the listeners to this podcast know, the Wells Fargo is in deep trouble right now because what happened was that this pressure on the tellers to sell financial products wound up misfiring in a disastrous way. And they were told that, like, every customer needed 8 financial products. This was not a number which was carefully arrived at through some kind of, like, series of anything. It was just a number which was arrived at because, I'm not making this up, it rhymed with great.
I think I have 8. I mean, it's like partly because I have kids and they have we have joint accounts and stuff like that. But I do want to say that I'm a Bank of America customer, shamefacedly. And every time I go to if I just deposit a check or something at the teller station, then I don't get upsold. But if for any reason I need to talk to the person in the front who's like in a suit, then absolutely they bring me into their office and tell me I need to, spend at least 45 minutes talking about all the financial products that I could be making money off of.
So, yeah, in any case, what happened at Wells Fargo is that the way they tried to incentivize the tellers to sell lots of financial products was really stupid. They basically said, sell lots of financial open lots of new accounts or you will be fired. And the tellers would try and open lots of new accounts, but often it's impossible because, like, sensible people really don't need 8 accounts unless your name is, unless you're Kathy. and so what the tellers would wind up doing, even though they were genuinely told they shouldn't do this because it's not good for Wells Fargo on a business level, is they would just open fake accounts in their customer's name. Or they would tell the customers that, yeah, you can get that, extra $20 you want, but you're going to have to open a credit card account. And don't worry about it. You'll get the credit card in the mail, but then you can just cut it up. Or they would just open credit card accounts without even asking the customers and put in fake email addresses for them. And it was a complete scandal, and they wound up having to pay a $185 million fine.
So I have a little bit of background with this stuff because I was talking to the SEIU, which is like the fastest growing union, in the country, and they were trying to unionize bank tellers. And I actually went to a meeting and talked to them when I was an occupier, talked to them about why they, why they shouldn't necessarily trust the banks that they've been working at. And we heard all sorts of stories from the bank tellers talking about these high pressure tactics and how they felt a lot of pressure to do things that they didn't find ethical. And this was 5 years ago. So this doesn't come as any surprise. I'm sure you saw, Felix, that a bunch of people are now coming forward, Wells Fargo, bank salespeople, saying that they actually complained about the ethics of the bank of the Wells Fargo quota system.
That doesn't get you very far.
They got fired.
Yeah.
They called the whistleblower ethics hotline, and then they got fired. Like, that's how Wells Fargo dealt with that.
So, Mr. Avon,
yes.
What does this teach us about the rise of the robots?
I think actually there's a very interesting story here in that if we think about the banking industry, it's not actually all that competitive, is it? I mean,
because it's really hard to compete on price. It's very hard for bank A to say, move your account to bank A because we are cheaper than Bank B. Moving an account is an incredibly painful thing to do. And people, A, don't really understand how much it costs in the first place because most of the costs are hidden. And B, for whatever $30 you're going to save, it's just not worth going through that kind of hassle.
Right. Absolutely. So it's not a very competitive industry. It's one that's saddled with all sorts of regulations. And when I think about the times I end up going to a bank, it's not because I needed some special kind of service that only tellers could provide. It's because I had to do something silly to like tick a box signing a lease form or something that needed a particular kind of check. I was jumping through regulatory hoops, basically. And these things could be eliminated, and probably without any great harm to society, if we sort of streamlined the rules. It's not necessarily in the bank's interest to get rid of these rules. But I think the broader point is that these jobs aren't necessarily very productive. I loved being in London because, for whatever reason, the retail banking there just worked fantastically smoothly. It was super easy to transfer money. Contactless payment just worked like magic. And I basically never went into any bank because I never needed to. I was much happier and more productive. And I think in a way there's a trade-off there between, we can create categories of jobs that survive if we are willing to protect them in various ways. And we don't necessarily need to do it in the way that we've done in the banking industry. We could also do it the way we've done in healthcare or in education by essentially making it very difficult to make these jobs more productive because people don't want necessarily to get online diagnoses or online education or because there are difficulties in competition there. But I think, where it is possible for the robots to come in and replace people, they tend to.
So I'm going to just mention one other job, which is briefly mentioned in your book, which was the slightly more surprising end of the future of labor in the world of the robots, and what happens when the robots arrive? What kind of jobs do we have? We haven't forgotten about this, darling listeners. This is going to happen. It's going to happen at some point in the foreseeable future. We are going to have an entire episode devoted to craft beer.
Oh, yeah. with actual live craft beer.
With actual live craft beer. And the economics.
Can I come back for that?
You can totally. You are okay. Totally.
Actually,
invited
can
back
I
for
just formally invite anyone who's ever visited Slate Money to be part of that?
We're just going to have a huge party and drink beer. And what's fascinating to me is that you look at craft beer, or naively, you look at the craft beer industry, and you see something very old-fashioned. But you make the argument quite convincingly, I think, that the rise of the craft beer industry is actually a function of the rise of the robots.
I think so. I mean, there are categories of employment, and I think it represents a growing slice of employment, where the value is all in the fact that machines weren't, being used to create the stuff at industrial scale, that it was guys kind of lovingly making the craft beer or the cheese or the chocolate or whatever artisanal thing is the latest.
It's
thing
what
to be featured
our friend Shane Farrow has called TQE, the quaint economy.
Exactly. And I think the reason we're seeing this is because when you live in proximity to people who are benefiting massively from these sort of technological changes because they're running hedge funds controlling tens of billions of dollars, or they're sitting atop a software firm that's fantastically profitable, you can skim off a share of the value that they're generating by selling them really expensive products that they like, because part of the joy of being a really rich person is you can buy these sort of luxury craft goods and show them off and enjoy the fact that you don't have to have the same mass-produced stuff as everyone else. And so I think that provided that we can allow people to live in close proximity to wealth, there's all sorts of opportunities to do this sort of thing. And I also tell a story about Raleigh, North Carolina, where I grew up, which is kind of this growing tech area. And surrounded by lots of farmland that used to just be people kind of, growing mass-produced crops or raising hogs to sell as cheap ham. But which increasingly they're producing things in kind of an artisanal way and selling it at high prices to all the new restaurateurs in the Research Triangle. Making 10 times what they're making on a hog before. And so that's one way to kind of spread the wealth a little bit, but it's limited by proximity. How many people can we fit in these metro areas that are being successful?
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so that's the human jobs.
Yeah.
But let's move on to the what you might call the robot jobs.
Yeah.
There's this evil robot running Amazon.com.
Yes. And
its name is Jeff Bezos.
And it's biased, weirdly, in favor of Amazon.com. And
and
according to ProPublica, this is scandalous. Kathy, what is going on here?
It's pretty misleading, I have to say. Well, like, first, we have to create the backdrop, which is, you know, Bezos' claim that Amazon is Earth's most customer-centric company. And the idea was that he was bravely, courageously inviting other sellers onto his marketplace because customers should get the best deal possible. And that was the idea. And that is definitely the way that people feel like they're experiencing their purchases on Amazon. It's not completely true. It turns out that people do not always get the best price to show up in the what's called the buy box. Now, the buy box is sort of the thing that Amazon pressures you to buy from. You don't have to buy from it. You could go to a sort of comparison shopping. Let's say you want to buy some glue. There's something that shows up in the buy box, and then you could go and click on saying, oh, I'd like to see more comparison shopping. Then a long list of things ranked somehow shows up. And if you look to see how it's ranked, it says it's price plus shipping. Turns out that's not actually how they do it. The ranking is a secret algorithm, secret pricing algorithm that Amazon won't really explain. But what ProPublica did was they figured out that for certain sellers, including Amazon and other sellers that are sort of within Amazon's inner circle.
They pay a fee to be quote-unquote fulfilled by Amazon.
Fulfilled by Amazon sellers. The shipping isn't part of that ranking system. So they only get ranked by their bare price, whereas the other sellers that are not in the Fulfilled by Amazon inner circle, they do get ranked by their price plus shipping. And it's even more complicated than that.
It's more complicated, but let's just leave it
there.
Let's
just stop there, yeah.
Because there are two different things going on here. I'm going to take the other side, like this is no scandal at all, side of the argument. And I'm going to say for two reasons. Number one, Jeff Bezos is being customer-centric here. Because if you look at the experience of me, if you look at the experience of the people I've talked to about this, overwhelmingly, not unanimously indeed, the thing that we're looking for when we're buying a thing from Amazon is not necessarily I can get it 75 cents cheaper. Like, we are interested in more than just price. We are also interested in just knowing that there's not going to be a problem and the thing is going to arrive. It's going to arrive quickly and I don't need to worry about whether and when it's going to arrive. And that Fulfilled by Amazon thing and the fact that the reason why I like buying from Amazon directly or from Amazon's warehouses directly where Amazon has physical possession of the goods and sends them to me is that I know that that is going to happen. I can trust that that will happen. If I buy from anyone else, I don't have that certainty. And so if Amazon puts that at the top of the list, what that is doing is it's being consumer-friendly to me because that's actually what I want. I want that certainty. That's the first thing. The second thing is that 90% of the people who buy from Amazon or fulfilled by Amazon don't pay any shipping.
So this is not affecting people with Amazon Prime. Is that what you're talking about?
Amazon Prime or just having enough stuff in your cart so that you don't need to pay a shipping fee.
Okay, so it's people who, yeah, I agree with you, and I have Amazon Prime, so this doesn't affect me directly. Although, like, as I said, there is a little complication in this algorithm. I don't necessarily, even when the shipping isn't a factor, I don't necessarily get the cheapest price. So I think you and I are different. Like, I don't feel good and about spending more money because it's coming from the Amazon warehouse personally, unless I was assured that it would actually cut down on like the amount of cardboard being used or something along those lines. Mm. I think the scandal here is that it is misleading to customers on the one hand, because it does really look like we are getting the best deal, and it's just not true. And second of all, it actually creates this weird dynamic within the companies who try to sell anything anywhere, that in order to get into the inner circle, they have to pay. So it's a real antitrust question.
Well, I mean, I think – so the first thing I thought of in kind of looking at the story and reading about it was that how much it reminded me of just a regular old grocery store, right? Because you've got – if you go into a grocery store, there are all kinds of different places on the aisle where, you know, things are particularly visible, and brands compete to kind of have their goods in those places. But then you can also get kind of the, you know, the Harris Teeter brand stuff. Some of this is price discrimination, right? So, you know, Harris Teeter or whichever grocery chain, we don't need to give Harris Teeter free advertising here, but they know that there are some bargain hunters who will look and spend the time to find things that are cheaper, and other people don't care. And so if you put stuff that's more expensive in a convenient spot, they'll just grab it. And that's just a way of kind of price discriminating, which happens all the time. We don't necessarily think is scandalous. And you see this also with
A convenience charge more than price discrimination.
But it's actually more than that. There's this weird kind of, I mean, if you're being harsh, you could call it like a protection racket thing that Amazon has going on, because in order to be fulfilled by Amazon, you need to pay Amazon a minimum of 15%. And similarly, in grocery stores, you get big companies like Procter & Gamble or Unilever paying grocery stores millions of dollars for placement, or Coca-Cola, people like that. You know, if you see a big Coca-Cola thing at the end of the aisle, that's because Coca-Cola is paying for it. Amazon and the grocery stores are not just making money on the stuff that they sell. They're also making money from directly from the distributors and manufacturers.
I'm just going to jump in and say that, like, my book just came out, and like, when I go to Barnes & Noble, it's really near the front of the store, but someone told me that Barnes & Noble makes more money from paying for placement, like you just mentioned, than from selling books. Isn't that incredible?
That is incredible.
And I don't know if that's actually true. Like, I have to check that. But the point being, like, it's a big part of what Barnes & Noble does.
Well, I think, I mean, when you've got this kind of two-sided market, right, the thing that you worry about is that there's economies of scale or network effects or whatever, but you end up with just one market, one marketplace, one seller who is able to be the place where everyone else has to be, and therefore has all kinds of market power. And then in that case, we really have a problem, because they're able – you don't have a choice. You know, there's not the competition that you want to see, and in that case, something has to be done. Now, the question is Amazon that powerful?
And the answer is, I think –
yes.
Probably yes. But, you know, now that Walmart has spent $3 billion buying Jet.com, maybe there's going to be a competitor.
One of the most interesting things about this article that ProPublica wrote about this is just the description of the different algorithm wars that are going on. So the sellers, even the ones that are not fulfilled by Amazon, especially them, they have all sorts of reasons to try to game this algorithm that is essentially secret. And they are building all these complicated bots to fight with the Amazon pricing bot. Really interesting.
And the one thing I did learn from Julia Angwin, who wrote the article, is the way to game the algorithm if you're just a buyer, if you're a consumer. And that's this. The secret is, you buy from sellers who are not fulfilled by Amazon, but who have a very high approval rating, somewhere in like the high 90s.
That makes you happy and makes me happy.
And who have more than like 10,000 ratings.
Yeah.
So if you do that, what happens is that what's essentially happening is that those sellers are taking all of the money that they would normally spend on Amazon, on, you know, paying Amazon to do all of their fulfillment for them, and they are spending that money on trying to provide a better than Amazon level of customer service.
We should reward them.
And you can reward them by buying their stuff. And one of the places that it really shows up is in returns, that if you try and return something to Amazon, it's possible, but it's non-trivial. It's a little bit of a pain. If you try and return something to a typical company on Amazon, which is not fulfilled by Amazon, but has a very, very high customer service rating, they will either make it unbelievably easy for you, or they will just say, you know what, just we'll refund you your money and you can keep it anyway.
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait, hold on. Let's go into that, because that seems like the way to go.
So that's the way to go. If you want to arbitrage the Amazon algo, that's what you do, is you buy from the people who are not fulfilled by Amazon, who have very high customer service rankings, and they will bend over backwards, because the only way that they manage to retain that ranking is by making all of their customers extremely happy.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. But it runs into a limit, right? And like, if we don't all cooperate to do this, then eventually Amazon can just tighten the screws a little bit. And
certainly Amazon can increase its fees for being fulfilled, or it can change the algorithm, or the margin, it can just stop being a platform altogether and say, we will only sell things if we can fulfill them.
Mm-hmm.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
It's time for the numbers round.
I'm going to start with 500 million, which you might know what it is. It's the number of Yahoo accounts that were hacked in 2014 that we just found out about yesterday.
That's a lot of accounts.
That's just a shit ton of accounts.
Yeah. Did you have a Yahoo account?
I'd never had a Yahoo account.
I apparently did have a Yahoo account. I had no idea that I had a Yahoo account, but I got an email from Yahoo today saying, your Yahoo account has been compromised. I'm like, ooh, I guess I had a Yahoo account.
I got that too. Yeah.
And Verizon didn't even know about it before they purchased Yahoo for, what, $5 billion? Yeah. Oof. They didn't know. I just find that outrageous.
Do you think this is a materially adverse piece of information which would allow them to back out from the acquisition?
That's a great question.
It is a great question.
I feel like, A, it is, that if they wanted to back out, they could, but that, B, it's not actually so material that they will want to back out, because it's all part of this. I mean, the way I see it is it's all part of this big sort of global spy versus spy war against the NSA by other state actors. And it's not really showing up in sort of things, you know, boring things like identity theft on a consumer level, but it's all part of like every single country wanting to have massive databases of every piece of information they can have in the
world. As I understand, the reason that they finally came clean about it was because some of these accounts were, the information was on sale.
Yeah, that's
pretty commercial.
A ridiculously low amount of money for like 3 bitcoins, you could buy like millions and millions.
That's not the point.
But it wasn't, you know, it didn't include credit card numbers, at least
directly.
Ryan,
well, so my number is 4. Which was the number of interest rate hikes that Stanley Fischer said we could expect in 2016. Ooh. He said that in January. And here it is.
Stan Fischer, who literally wrote the book on macroeconomics. No one knows more than Stan Fischer. And yet,
which means
somehow,
nobody knows anything.
Nobody knows anything.
We've managed to get how many so far?
We've had 0 in 2016.
Whoops.
I just totally called that. I just want to, for the record, remember everybody? Everybody remember us. I called it.
Yeah, so there'll still be 2 more opportunities before the end of the year is over, but 2 is less than 4.
Less than 4.
Yeah.
My number is 2.42. 2.42 is the number of cents per kilowatt that Abu Dhabi has now agreed to pay for electricity from a massive new solar-powered electricity project. It is, I'm going to say this, the cheapest contract for electricity ever signed anywhere on planet Earth using any technology.
It's amazing.
2.242 cents per kilowatt is not just way cheaper than the electricity you get from natural gas plants. It's way cheaper than just the cost of the natural gas going into those plants. So if you were wondering when solar power was going to become cheaper than like fossil fuels, it has now happened.
That
at
is
least
so
in Abu Dhabi.
Good.
Although, interestingly, again, this comes back to Ryan's Wealth of Humans thing, that the reason it's so cheap in Abu Dhabi is partly because, obviously, Abu Dhabi has a shit ton of sunlight, which is very abundant, and That's great for solar power. But it's also because Abu Dhabi has a shit ton of unbelievably cheap labor. And so the cost of installing this all of these solar panels when you get like cheap immigrant labor in the Emirates is way, way low.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they don't extend very many protections to those immigrant workers.
It's a great deal for electricity. It's not probably such a great deal for the workers who are having to install it. Well, okay then. I think that's it. We've had three numbers. We've had a fantastic conversation with Ryan Avent, whose book, The Wealth of Humans, is available in all good bookstores and also Amazon. thank you, Ryan, for turning up for this thing. Thank you to all of the massive number of various Slate producers who are involved in this show, which is about four times greater than it normally is. And I'm not even going to attempt to name them all. They're in two different cities and it's complex. So thank you to you guys, the listeners. Keep the emails coming. The email is, as ever, slatemoney@slate.com. I have a question for you this week, which is, are you just comforted by listening to this podcast on Saturdays or whenever you listen to it? Or is it something which you would actually like to see some other stuff mixed into the feed, like, you know, one-on-one interviews with policymakers or like random stuff like that? Do you want change or do you want like a comforting same thing every week?
Continuity. I'm going for continuity.
So that's the question for you this week. So check out the whole roster of Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.